Warning: The Mended Futures podcast contains stories told by guests that may be sensitive to some people. Viewer and listener discretion is advised. The opinions expressed by guests do not reflect the views of the hosts and/or producers of this podcast.
On today's episode, you're going to meet Trade Watkins, who is a local community leader who has a passion for fatherhood. Mm-hmm. He has a passion for mentoring young men. We talk about a lot of basic things.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the basics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We talk a little bit about systems and the need for systemic change.
Yep. Yeah. As we were talking before we recorded his episode, he summed it up pretty well himself. He said, you know, I just try to lead a purpose-driven life. So we hope you enjoy.
Yes. We have a special guest today, and can you tell the audience who you are? And think about it more than who you are professionally or who you are personally. So think about who you are in all the ways.
Well, that's a great way to put that question. Because that's how I try to look at who I am, and not just as a professional, but personally. So my name is Trey Watkins, and I'm a native of Lynchburg, Virginia. I grew up with my grandmother and had a somewhat of a chaotic childhood. I say that proudly, just because of my journey and the way that I've been able to overcome a lot of those barriers and challenges and become an inspiration for a lot of young people that look like myself and been through a lot of those similar situations. So I'm the CEO and founder of Inward Solutions. I'm a transformative life coach, and I'm a strong advocate for Black men and boys. And truly and honestly, I'm an advocate for families. Mm. I say Black men and boys because we don't put as much of an emphasis as mm-hmm. I feel like we need to on Black men and boys. And a lot of Black men and Black males just feel neglected. And until we put a specific emphasis on Black males, most of us just feel excluded. Mm. so I want to make sure that, you know, Black males feel heard and feel supported. But I'm just a strong advocate for families. And that's why I appreciate everything that 518 is doing here in the community and all throughout this area. And it's a whole lot I can say. I grew up in Rivermont. I like to tell people I grew up on both sides of Rivermont. Mm. And if you're not familiar with Lynchburg, Rivermont Avenue is an area in Lynchburg, Virginia. On one end, it starts on Daniels Hill, and it goes all the way into what we call Boonesboro. But, you know, I went to high school in Boonesboro, and I was able to get a scholarship there. But I grew up in a very rough environment in Daniels Hill in the 90s and early 2000s. And I was able to earn a scholarship into a very prestigious boarding private school here in Lynchburg that didn't even know existed at the time, ironically. But, you know, I tell people I grew up on both sides because I've been a bridge my whole life. Mm. I've been able to be the person that can communicate and answer questions and deliver messages from, you know, two different worlds is the way I see it. And frankly, everyone else has been able to see it, you know. When I first went to VES, you know, a lot of my friends and faculty and staff would often just ask me questions about what it was like growing up and what that world is like and continues to be like. And then when I would go home on the weekends, they would say the same thing. They would say, what's it like living in this world that we've never seen before? Literally, mm-hmm. you know, like I said, before I went to VES, Virginia Episcopal School, I didn't even know that side of town even existed. Wow. I'd never been past Virginia Baptist Hospital.
Wow.
We just literally had no reason. I went to Lincoln Elementary School, so mm-hmm. we would take that Langhorne Road, and that light that's there at Virginia Baptist Hospital, the second light, never went past it. I remember the first time I went over there, I was like, wow, so you crops over here. And so it's interesting. And so, as I developed throughout my life and became a student of VES, I earned a scholarship over at VMI to VMI to play football. Hmm. And I got a degree in psychology. And that experience within itself was very unique and very challenging. Probably one of the greatest accomplishments I've ever maybe ever will. Graduating from VMI is very challenging. Mm. I'm so grateful and so thankful I was able to make it through. But that certainly had a lot to do with shaping who I am and who I've become, and seeing a lot of different things from a different lens and a different perspective, whether it's through the military culture or just through a different, almost a different political culture. Just seeing things from the lens of like Southerners. Mm-hmm. I'd never considered myself a Southerner. I went to Boston one time and they said, "Oh yeah, that Southern guy from Virginia." And I was like, "I'm a Southerner." Never hadn't even thought about it before. But anyways, and so I graduated. I'm in a move into Baltimore.
Nice.
And that's when my life got very interesting, and I began to. And despite all the different, you know, culture shocks and different paradigm shifts from being on different sides of Rivermont and then going to a school like VMI, Baltimore was probably the experience that really changed my lens and the way that I saw things. I began to get a very deep appreciation and gratitude for the way that I grew up. Up until that point, if you'd asked me, I said, it was hard. I had it, you know, tough. And I mean, when I say chaotic, I went to 7 different elementary schools, to give an example.
Wow.
Right. I mean, it was just no stability whatsoever. And so it was very challenging. I had an excellent childhood. You hear me? Like, I had a great childhood compared to what I saw in the couple of years that I lived in Baltimore working and, you know, at a outpatient mental health facility in a school. And we literally worked at the school that had the lowest test scores in the entire state of Maryland.
Wow.
And so it was an experience. It was many different agencies, tons of really good people that, you know, you have to have a strong desire to want some change and some impact to work in an environment like that. So the school was full of really good people, but the circumstances and the challenges were so incredibly overwhelming from, you know, I mean, on the sidewalks of the schools, I mean, there's heroin needles and vials everywhere. I mean, I remember my first day, I brought a broom after the first day and I saw kids picking them up and throwing them at each other, like second and third graders. And I didn't know what it was. And I went to go reach to pick it up and I didn't realize what it was. And it was residue on it. Right. And if you know anything about, you know, hard drugs like that, I mean, it can easily seep through it, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, second and third graders put their fingers in their mouths a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I could not believe what I was saying, and there was plenty of adults around, right?
Yeah.
And so the next day, I brought my push broom with me and just started cleaning the sidewalks. And, you know, it led to some respect, but it was still rough,
yeah.
You know, in that neighborhood. They're very protective of their territory and, you know, some deep trust issues. And so you have to earn everything that you get out there. And so... But it just everything there. I mean, the Baltimore gets really cold in the winter. I don't think people realize how cold Baltimore actually gets in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. It's extremely cold. And at the school, I mean, there was just heat in the very middle of the school, like in a staircase. And it had like these old radiator heaters. And that would heat the entire school, right? So they would open the doors of every floor in the stairwells. And so the heat would then disseminate through the hallways, right? But I was working in a class and like as a behavior specialist at the very end of the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so cold at the end of the hallway. I mean, if you peeped your head in the window and look in the classroom, it looked like you were watching like a Buffalo Bills game in the January.
Oh my gosh.
You could just see everybody's breath.
Wow.
Right. And kids had on mittens that didn't have fingers on them. Mm. And I went on trying to write and I'm like, this is incredible. And like we started having to have class in the hallway. I'm saying all these things because these were the type of experiences that I had that really shaped who I am today. And that's driving me to really want to do something very impactful that can really change some things, not just in Lynchburg, but just globally even, right? Just really making a difference. And I think with Inward Solutions, we can do that. You know, it's really about, I say inward because I realized that in Baltimore, when I was at the school, my sister, she worked at the agency, and that's how I got connected with that school. And she was partnering and working with some folks in the Obama administration who had vowed to send people from his administration to the school who had the lowest test scores in every single state, right? Mm-hmm. And so they would often come to the school. And I'm thinking to myself, man, I was one day I was excited. I'm like, they finally here. You know, all these Suburbans pull out from D.C. And I'm like, it's going to be a change here. And they were in a very long meeting. And when they came out the meeting, I ran over to them. I'm like, all right, so what's the verdict? And they're like, they're not going to give us anything, right, in terms of funding. And I didn't understand it at the time, but I completely understand it now. And the truth is, dude, it doesn't matter how much money you pour into that. Money isn't going to change a thing. It's not going to change anything. That area and Baltimore itself has almost, I mean, not Baltimore itself, but certain areas have become like a permanent underclass. It's hard to wrap your mind around what that is sometimes, but it's a point of no return, basically. And it's a hard thing to realize and a reality that really sets in. But it's when you reach a certain level of poverty, and to the point where there is no return in that area, you essentially are going to have to leave as the only option. And it doesn't matter if you could drop $1 trillion in that area. It is it's not going to change anything, unfortunately. It may even make it worse.
And as I'm listening to you, you know, I like to study change and I like to study systems. And the older I get, the more I think about macro. I like to zoom out and see more and more macro. You're seeing and you're talking about the perspectives of systems are designed to get the results that they get. And we pour money and resources towards things and it can still be inefficient. It can still be unproductive. The amount of people that plug into the most vulnerable, there's so many things at work, the burnout, the, you know, what you're describing, the destitute poverty or the multi-generational poverty or, you know, the things that are normalized, hearing you talk about the heroin needles. When things become normalized, people don't think twice about kids touching needles or kids carrying drugs or kids, you know, that is a reality in our neighborhoods. That's a reality here in our region.
It is.
So I think it's important for folks to hear, no matter where you are as an audience, that in your own neighborhood, you may not even know what's in the next zip code, or you may not even know what's
down the other side of your own zip code.
I will never forget when we were talking. He wasn't on the couch, but he was. I think his screen was on the couch. The founder of Care Portal lives in Kansas City, Missouri, and he was talking about how his organization was working for global orphans. And he said, we were flying over orphans to get to another country. We were flying over our own orphans. And when you think about who are the orphans are the fatherless, the motherless. And we are surrounded here by so many issues, definitely orphans. And I know that fatherhood is a huge part of your mission. So Absolutely. Can you tell us a little bit on, you know, how did you get to that as a part of your focus as well?
So my fatherhood initiative and having a strong desire with that is all sort of interconnected, but specifically it had to do with my own, you know, relationship with my father. So I grew up with my mom, my sister, very briefly, my mom, my sister, and who I thought was my father. My mother, him and my mother also thought that he was my father as well. Unfortunate situation. But when I was 10 years old, I realized, and we all realized, he wasn't my father. And I never met my father yet. And when I did meet my father, he was having some alcohol issues. And, you know, it just wasn't the best time or the best circumstance to really try to begin building that relationship. And my family at the time, you know, my grandmother, my uncle, my sister, the people that were really taking care of me, my mother was struggling with addictions and I was living with my grandmother. And so they were very protective of my feelings and my future. And they didn't want me to get distracted and get emotionally damaged by trying to get involved with somebody that just wasn't ready at the time mm-hmm. and someone that also needed some healing, right? And that relationship didn't begin to develop until I was in college, you know, when I was about 19 years old. And I just had some questions. And it was weird. The reason I reached out to my dad was because I was walking somewhere and somebody noticed while I was at school. It was like, dude, you got a patch in the back of your head. I was like, what? It was like, yeah, it's like real smooth. And I was like, what? it was almost like a perfect circle. And like in the back of your head. And my hair was like maybe this long. Right. Yeah. So it was very noticeable.
Yeah.
And it was alopecia. And okay. I didn't know.
So I wondered if you were going to say something medical. Oftentimes yeah. you want to know something biological.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what alopecia was. Mm-hmm. And I'm freaking out because I got this like quarter size right. like plug in the back of my head. And so, you know, I started looking into it and they were saying, you know, some of this stuff comes from what was called Agent Orange, which was a chemical that was sprayed in Vietnam and a lot of people, Vietnam veterans, right, were affected by that. My father was in the Vietnam War
wow.
and he had contracted Agent Orange. And that's how myself and one of my sisters had alopecia.
Wow.
And so in the midst of that conversation is how we began developing a relationship. And that would then go on for like the next 2 years and just really building some momentum. And it got to the point where when I would come home from school, I was going to his house first. I was talking to him on a weekly basis. We were really developing a relationship. I gotten to the point where, you know, I'm telling you now that I love you, right? Mm-hmm. And previously, we had this moment, this really strong moment where, you know, I just realized that like I had told him I loved him before, but it was a moment where I realized that I really meant it, mm-hmm. right? And when he told me he loved me back, I knew that he meant it. And it's not that, you know, he probably did mean it, but I believed him this time, mm-hmm. right? And that's where we were in our relationship. A few months later, unfortunately, he passed in a car accident, right?
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, 30 days before that, my brother had passed in a car accident. I had a stepbrother.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going through a rough time. And, you know, and at the time, like I was playing football, I had a big shoulder injury.
Mm-hmm.
It was a mess.
Yeah.
And life was moving so fast that I didn't really have the time to grieve. You know, it was my senior year in college and it was just so much going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a few years down the road and I began to, you know, because when he passed, I'll be honest, I was very angry at God.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't understand why, you know, you would introduce me after all this time to my father. We developed a strong relationship and then poof, gone out of nowhere. And I was very angry and it took me a while to begin healing. And when I did, I finally realized and I fell to my knees just thanking God. Like, and it was one of the best things that ever happened to me, I realized. And I realized what God did for me. And I so desperately needed to seek my dad and get to know him so that I could get to know myself, but to also give me the tools I needed to heal. Because if I hadn't really taken the time to get to know him and have that relationship and plant some seeds for healing and to hear him apologize to me and understanding the importance of that, right, then I certainly wouldn't be the father that I am today. Mm-hmm. And I certainly wouldn't have the compassion and the patience and some of the things that right that you need just as a human, but more so as a parent and as a mentor. And I realized, man, this is one of the best things that ever happened to me. And I, in the midst of all of that, I began to realize the importance. And I'm like, I don't think people quite understand how devastating it is not having your father. Right. And because it's such a prevalent issue. Right. It's so commonplace that we forget that it's just as important. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I tell people sometimes take a step back and imagine if the amount of kids that don't have their fathers, what if they didn't have their mothers? How would we look at it? Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. Right. Mm-hmm. And we look at a lot of social issues and a lot of things that are going on with our youth today. And when you go generation after generation after generation of so many children who didn't have their father, now their parents, and they're either also not around, or, you know, their mother is trying to raise them. I mean, it's just a issue that just compounds on top of each other. And we look at where we are today, and I can't think of a better way to begin solving some of these issues than to begin empowering mm-hmm. and developing fathers, mm-hmm. right, to be the advocates and the ambassadors and everything that we need them to be in the community to solve a lot of social issues. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm an advocate for men and boys, and a lot of it has to do with that. I'm like, you know, we see the violence and the gun violence and the gang activity everywhere, Lynchburg included, right? And how do we solve it, mm-hmm. right? It's going to take, women have done an incredible job. Like, I was raised by my grandmother, my aunt, my sisters. You ain't got to tell me how strong and incredible women are, right? Mm-hmm. I'm in support of women 100%. But at some point, we have to get back to a balance. And we have to uplift men, really, who are hurting mm-hmm. and empower them to get out here and do everything that we need them to do for the sake of our society.
Invite them back into the space, you know?
Yeah.
And I think having heard you and a number of fathers speak at a community event in October about the importance of fatherhood, I left there, and this is a space that I work in, you know, but I left there thinking, you know, what is my part as a mom to make sure that fathers feel empowered and invited into the space? But also, you all posed some deep, deep questions or planted some seeds. Fathers are missing for many reasons. Do we ever think about why and how, you know, it could be a death. It could be something that is a double trauma.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just an absence. So I appreciate, as a mother, I appreciate the recent emphasis on fatherhood mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. because I think it's so important, like you're talking about, the balance, yeah. the, you know, and it takes a village. It takes lots of, I mean, you're listing off all the women in your family that helped you. You know, you need lots of women and men to be a part of the village.
Absolutely. And for me personally, I had that despite not having my father mm. or my mother, essentially, I still had many women and men around me that helped me. This, like I said, despite all the barriers and challenges, mm-hmm. I was able to get to where I am now. And you're right, it takes a village. But at the same time, you know, there's no replacing your parents, right? There's no replacing your mother. There's no replacing your father. And you need it. And one of the things that stood out one time when I was doing counseling in Richmond, I was working I had clients in Gilpin Court, Mosby Court. If you're familiar with Richmond, those areas are, it's the closest thing I've seen to anything in Baltimore, mm-hmm. right? Very rough. And I had a client, just very serious behavioral issues. And one thing I would often do, and I tell people all the time, I'm like, there's no such thing as working with kids. You work with families mm-hmm. because at the end of the day, if I'm working with this kid and he's, then goes right back into the same environment, right, where whether it's grandmother, mom, sister, dad, whoever is in the house, they're reinforcing, mm-hmm. you know, the things that are causing this behavior. And so you have to coach everybody in the household. And so sometimes when there's not a positive male, you know, in the environment, I try to invite someone who I think would be helpful, right? I'm like, do you have a uncle, a cousin, you know, somebody that you look up to? Preferably dad, but dad is typically a very sensitive subject and usually mm-hmm. the root cause of all that anger and conduct disorder, right? But if it's possible, sometimes I would take that risk and chance because it's worth it. Some kids are so enraged and being caused by that you know, missing father that all they need is a little bit. One situation, though, I invited dad and mom was very skeptical and, you know, was hesitant. But I said, I have a good feeling about this. And, you know, he wasn't doing very well, you know. And I said I would reach out to him and I would go meet with him and try to talk to him and coach him up prior to inviting him over to their apartment and us having a sit down as a family and just having a tough, very difficult conversation, but one that needed to happen nonetheless. And it was short, and there wasn't a whole lot said, but it was one of the most powerful things that I've ever seen happen. And when he came in and sat down, immediately the kid started crying. I mean, he wasn't boohooing, but tears were just pouring out of his eyes. And he probably hadn't seen his father in over a decade. Hadn't spoken to him, hadn't talked to him, right?
And that is so common.
Yeah.
I don't know the story that you're talking about, but there are dozens of kids right around us who have the exact same situation going on.
I was in the same situation. I had a man in my life, right, and a father figure, but it turns out I'm like, you're not even my dad. I haven't met my dad before. Mm-hmm. And I found it out when I was 10. And so, I told him, I said, listen, I don't want to tell you what to say. I don't want to tell you how to be, but, you know, just have just do your best to have a level of compassion and understanding for how your son is going to feel and how mom is going to feel, mm-hmm. right? And how they've been feeling this whole time. And he said, he started off and he said, son, and he looked him in his eyes and he apologized. Sometimes I get emotional thinking about this stuff. Like, yeah. It was such a powerful situation, but he apologized to his son. And it was like, you could see the rage and like, if there was, and I don't like using this word, but like, if there was like a demon, little demon inside of him or something, right? Because this kid was really...
It's primal.
Right. I mean, you could literally see it. It was almost as if I could see it leaving his body and like just drifting into the air somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
When he apologized, and this kid was very angry towards his mom. He blamed his mom for everything that had ever occurred, despite the fact that his mom was the only person that was ever there for him, doing everything for him. But... all the problems in his mind, he would take it out on mom. He would try to hit mom. He would blame her for everything. And he said, he apologized to him. And then he looked at mom and then he looked back at him and said, I'm to blame. Your mother hasn't done, your mother's done, she loves you and she's done everything she can to take care of you. Do not blame your mom for what I've done. And he took full responsibility.
Mm.
We all were crying. I mean, it was just like, it was the most powerful thing.
For it to happen right away.
Yeah. And when I say to you, like a week later, totally different kid.
Wow.
Like it was his teachers. I got to find like the emails and like the letters from his teachers. It was just like, none of us could believe it. And that's never left my mind. It really just showed me something. It was like, this is powerful, and this is what we need. We need more reconciliation, and we need more, coming to the table to have these difficult conversations, because these kids desperately need it. Some of them don't want it, but some of them do.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of whether they want it or not, it's probably some of the best things for them, and their healing journey was best for me, and it's best for that kid.
So... can I ask you to break that down a little bit more? As someone who is a community advocate, as someone who has done this work before, if someone's listening, if a mom is listening who has a son who is similar to the case that you just explained, or if there's an estranged father out there who's listening, how could you... individually help someone who feels stuck in that situation, or how can you give people advice to do something like you just said? Like, how do you set the stage for something that will be transformative, whether it's mindset, identity, what would you say? I mean, it was your job kind of as a caseworker or as an employee to do that. Mm-hmm. How could other people arrange to be on the same team as their child?
Well, I will first start and say, if you're a parent, if you're someone who has in a circumstance, in a situation like that, where you have a child you know, that's having some issues like that, right? If you don't have a mentor or a counselor, or if you don't, they're not in therapy, I would highly recommend that. They definitely need some support. They need to be heard. They need to have the ability to really speak and express how they feel and get that out of them. That's a very first step. And if, when that happens, you know, and this is what I want to say to agencies. Like, I think agencies really need to embrace the idea of doing this type of work, coaching their counselors, you know, to really, sometimes you're going to have to take some risks, you know, and it is risky at times, but you really just need to think about what can be done to solve some of these root problems. I'm a root guy, mm-hmm. right? I look at things on a spectrum, and when I look at what's going on and the things we're talking about, we're on the dark red end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's burgundy out here, mm-hmm. right?
In some of these families, it's life and death.
Yes.
In some of the,
yes.
when I think about it, whether from the mental health standpoint mm-hmm. or whether from the violence standpoint, the work that is being done with families and young people and boys specifically,
yeah,
it is life and death.
Yeah, it is. It truly is. And I don't want to go down that road, but I will say it's for girls too.
Mm-hmm.
But,
absolutely.
And we've talked about it, but yes. but specifically for the boys. And but I would say, you know, the mindset that it takes is really understanding the power in the little things. You know, small things matter. Mm-hmm. I tell people all the time, dude, everybody should be mentoring. If you don't have one person, young person in your life that you're mentoring, right? We all should be doing that. Just one. That's all you need is mm-hmm. one. One person mentored me and it got me a scholarship. That scholarship led to four or five other scholarships, like people in my neighborhood getting scholarships mm-hmm. to the same school.
Wow.
It changed the trajectory of my entire neighborhood off one gesture and one person mentoring one person. Mm-hmm. So like, that's capable. Like yeah. I'm a walking example of that.
Yeah.
And we need, you know, it's a mindset of like the little things and understanding how much it matters. We overlook the importance of fatherhood. So we don't think that it's the answer, right? So
right.
you have to have the mindset to really look at things that seem small.
Go back to the basics.
Going back to the
and
basics.
And I want to add to this because I embrace my nerdiness. The region of Lynchburg, led by a couple of very learned academics, we've been exposed to something called the 40 developmental assets.
Sure.
And so there's a coalition that you're a part of called the 40 Ways Coalition. And I want to highlight something that Trey was just talking about, because you cannot underestimate the importance of some of these small things. If a young person can self-report that there are three people in their lives that are not their guardians who care about them. So it could be a community member, it could be a mentor, it could be whoever you are in this community, in this village along the Vision 30 River. If you are pouring into kids that are not your kids, research says that that is incredibly powerful. Research, these same research points say that if you involve your child in an after-school activity, that's 3 hours or more a week. So think about Little League coaches, think about extracurriculars, think about Boys and Girls Club, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, yep. community centers. There are certain things that we know to be true that have been studied, and Trey just highlighted one of those. So mentoring, never underestimate pouring into a kid that's not related
and
to
you. And sometimes we've abandoned those things,
mm-hmm.
right? We've forgotten the importance of it.
Mm-hmm.
We've forgotten the importance of after-school programs and how mm-hmm. helpful it is. I think we've not abandoned it. It's just we need a splash of reality sometimes and mm-hmm. get back to what we know and what we've seen the research, you know, tell us that it works. We were, like when I was growing up, you know, I was blessed that there were so many different programs. And in my mind, if you would have told me that, you know, in the 90s, you know, that in 2025, we'd have less of those programs than we do now, I wouldn't have believed it, because I would have been like, how is that possible? Mm-hmm. Right? I'm like, if this is how it is now, 30-something years from now, this problem will be solved, mm-hmm. right? And unfortunately, we forget sometimes, and we lose focus, and we tend to, you know, we just simply don't realize the importance of it. Sometimes we look at data. I'm big on data, but sometimes data don't tell you everything, mm-hmm. right? We can't, data doesn't spell out everything. And you know, someone isn't going to tell you all the time, you know, how much it mattered to them when you did something.
Yep.
And the difference that it made. That's never going to go on a paper in a box anywhere, right, with a number on it.
It might 30 years later when you're on a podcast.
There you go. You know? In all seriousness.
And yeah. I constantly say, and people are probably tired of me already for saying this, just keep sowing the seeds, because you may never, ever see the harvest. But when we get older, you know, as we're thinking about our midlife crises or how did we get here, we oftentimes go back and thank the people that got us here in those pivotal moments.
Yeah. Like I was saying, the moment I was in Baltimore and walked into that school and started looking around, immediately began having gratitude. I'm like, you know what? Lincoln Elementary is an excellent school. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like every school that I went to, if I wanted to use education, right, mm-hmm. as my path, there was nothing in the way. If I was hungry, always had something to eat. If mm-hmm. I was cold, right, there was always heat. If I was hot, there was always air. I felt safe. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I felt safe at mm-hmm. the time. Oh, I was safe. Right. And
there are levels of
yeah. right. And I it's little things, right? It, mm-hmm. it makes a difference. And sometimes in the midst of all the challenges and we feel overwhelmed, we also have to give ourselves some credit for the things that we do and how much of a difference it's made and the progress that's been made, mm-hmm. right? Despite them saying stuff about the programs, we've done a lot and we're doing well in certain areas, right? We just have to get back to the basics, Allison, right? Some of the things you said, like, we just have to get back to what we know works and just continue to stay persistent with it and continue to empower, mm-hmm. you know, different organizations like 518, right? And mm-hmm. and people that are dedicated and committed to serving families. I can't state the importance of families enough. Mm-hmm. Like, it's when we talk about poverty, when we talk about so many things, to me, I how do we not look at what's going on behind that closed door? Mm-hmm. And as the, you know, the issue and the solution, right?
Yeah. So.
Hey friends, let's talk about real impact. Imagine a single mom struggling to keep her family together or a child sleeping on the floor because they don't have a bed. Now imagine you being able to meet that need. That's exactly what happens every day through Care Portal.
Care Portal is a platform that connects real-time needs from local children and families to people like you, churches and individuals who want to make a difference. With just a few clicks, you can step in, meet a need, and build a meaningful connection that changes lives.
This isn't just charity. It's the church and the community coming together, showing up in love and action. So if you're ready to turn compassion into action, visit careportal.org and see how you can be a part of the movement, because connection changes everything.
Visit careportal.org for more information on how to sign up and start meeting the needs of children and families in your own zip code. Once again, that's careportal.org.
Thank you, Care Portal, for sponsoring the Mended Futures podcast.
So in this season with Inward Solutions, I'm curious how you build trust with people, because you've talked about how you were working from a school perspective and then you were working from a counselor's perspective. So you essentially had people coming to you, right? But correct me if I'm wrong, but in this season, it seems like you're more in a situation where you go and enter in. So how do you kind of break down those walls and establish trust?
So I got my hand in a little bit of everything, to mm-hmm. be honest, and I'm all over the place, it feels like, at times. But I'll give you an example, mm-hmm. a good example. One of the things I'm doing, I'm an interviewer for a research project through the University of Virginia on youth gun violence, right? Mm-hmm. So I interview young people between 13 and 25 all throughout the state of Virginia, and we talk about, and we're trying to get to the root causes and finding some solutions I love the approach that we're taking with this project because we're talking to real people with real experiences so we can find real solutions opposed to just, you know, sitting around a table with people that think that they know and say, okay, here you go. And
testing then, theories.
Right. And so, and it's been going so well. And we did a presentation on Valentine's Day, unfortunately. we did a presentation at UVA in front of a bunch of people, some lawmakers and some policy folks. And when we did this presentation and I explained to them, is because one of the biggest questions they had was like, how were you able to get these young people to open up and trust you enough to say some of the things that they said? Because some of the quotes that we've gotten from this research is, I mean, it is super powerful stuff. Mm-hmm. And it caused you to pause. And they're like, how did you get these young people to do that? And I said, well, part of it is, and I don't want to sound like a bragger, but it's just mm-hmm. like I'm uniquely qualified to talk to these young people, right? I can relate to them. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Richmond at times. Like, I lived in Lynchburg, but I also grew up in Richmond. That's why all these different schools I'm talking about. There was years where gunshots every night, mm-hmm. every night. I mean, to the point where it's just, you stop ducking on the floor. You know what I mean? You're just mm-hmm. like, oh.
It's normalized.
It's normalized, right? And I know what it's like to see my uncles, my cousins, you know, my stepdad, people like that. They're not leaving out the door without a gun on them because, you know, that could mean he's not walking back through the door anymore. Mm-hmm. And so up front, I explained to them who I am, what I'm doing, why I'm doing it, and everything, some of the other things that I'm doing, and getting them, trying to reassure them that they can be honest and that. And I empowered them too. I let them know the feedback and your participation in this research is incredibly powerful. Literally, what you tell me can literally make the difference, whether it's a grant funding, a policy, some type of legislation change. Like what you say in this interview, very well could be the very thing that changes the state and could change this country.
Wow.
So and they love the opportunity to speak about it. I haven't spoke to one young person that did not just deeply appreciate someone just asking them how they felt about it. Mm, like
they were prompted.
Yeah.
Taylor knows that I love generational stuff mm-hmm. and I don't do it. I try not to do it from a place of judgment. I love talking to young people. So my personal children are Gen Alpha. Most of the teenagers that we're working with right now would be very young Gen Z. Mm-hmm. And what I have noticed over the last definitely 10 years is kids, young people absolutely want a seat at the table mm-hmm. and they want their voice to be heard. Mm-hmm. And I want to reiterate, Trey is uniquely qualified. We're all uniquely qualified for something.
Yeah.
And young people realize when someone authentically wants the best for them mm-hmm. and authentically cares about what they're saying. And I think change happens at the speed of trust, and trust is so important. So if you want to work with young people and you want to do work that impacts them, you have to be authentic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to.
Trust is, I emphasize that again too, that, you know, authentic, absolutely. Trust is if we could find, I mean, trust mm-hmm. is such an important.
I wish you could sell it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my I really God. Wish you could.
I'd invest everything
in
it.
Yeah. I love dogs too. dogs and teenagers can see right through you.
Oh. They got serious radar.
It's mm-hmm. it's hilarious.
Their antennas are strong. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's something to realizing that your heart's not in it, or that you're not genuinely in mm-hmm. it for them. So shout out to the dogs and the teenagers.
Yeah, they the one other thing is like that I've realized from that research and talking to young people, these young kids are incredibly smart. Mm-hmm. I mean, their grades may not reflect it. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing, too. It's like, I'm like, I'll talk to these kids, and some of them are doing, I mean, extremely well. Like, I mean, academically, I mean, but Some of them, I interviewed a kid from Hampton, for example. He was 13 years old. He had just gotten out of a juvie detention for robbing a grown man at gunpoint, right?
Wow.
And I interviewed him, and super smart kid, just didn't feel safe, did not feel safe ever. And I mean, he didn't have his parents, and he's like, I was out here trying to survive, basically. I mean, 13-year-old kid, it was heartbreaking.
Wow.
But incredibly smart. And these kids have the solutions. Like, they understand far more than we think that they do. And one of the older kids, like, I think it was like 16 or 17, he said to me, he said, I understand and I understand why adults think that we're just dumb kids with guns and dumb kids that don't really understand the world. But what y'all don't understand is that we actually understand way more than you think we do. And we're just doing what we have to do. And y'all don't take the time to understand why we do the things that we do and the experiences that we've had, you know, what it was like for us during COVID. Right. And we're just out here doing the best that we can. And that was one of the kids that was just, like I said, deeply appreciative of the platform and the ability to be heard and speak.
I want to highlight something that you've talked about, and we have it down as one of our questions as well. Male mental health. I really like to hear you say, you know, you have a degree in psychology, you're working with folks through consulting, looking at the whole family. Talk about why you think mental health is important, because I think there are so many stigmas around talking to people, processing things, reflecting. I mean, you're covering lots of taboo topics. So talk to us about why you believe in mental health.
This might be the most important topic we're talking about that we bring up today. Mental health in general, let's be real, in general, it doesn't matter what demographic you're speaking of. It's a very, very serious topic. However, when you look at the mental health statistics when it comes to Black males, it is off the charts. We're talking about the highest rising rate of suicide, Black men between 18 and 45.
You think of that as a white male epidemic. Men are starting to commit suicide at alarming rates, is what you're saying.
We have the highest rate. And we have those same thoughts about kids. No, that's not since I think it was 2022. That's no longer the case. Black kids are Black boys are committing suicide at the highest rate of all the demographics of kids. So it's if you just Google Black boys, Black males suicide, anything of that nature, you would be so shocked and surprised what pops up and how many articles are talking about it, how many things are out there, but it's not being talked about enough, right? It's never at the forefront of any of the discussions that we have. And
do you think that's a religious component? Why do you think that is?
It's a lot of it's cultural.
Why don't we talk about mental health?
Well, I'll speak to it from why we don't talk to it when it comes to Black males. I think we are talking about it. As it relates to Black males, we don't talk about it. And the reason is because we don't see it as mental health. When you open a newspaper or you read an article or turn on the news and you see a Black male, right, and whatever situation, this crazy situation it is, we look at it from a lens of crime or violence, right? We're not looking at it from a mental health perspective. You know, we just say, wow, that was crazy. What would cause that person to do something like that? Somebody with PTSD.
Right.
Somebody with a mental illness. That's the reality of what you're looking at. It's just when it looks very different in different environments, right? Certain mental health looks just different when you look at it and you put it in a different situation. And an environment where it's almost by street code illegal and against the law to be vulnerable, soft.
It's
unsafe to be that way, but it culturally it's a big no-no. So I could be suffering the worst mental health imaginable. I'm not even allowed to begin to show anything physically, any type of expression that I'm hurting in any kind of way. One, because of safety, but two, it's just socially unaccepted. Mm-hmm. That's not just the case with, you know, outside the home. That's the case inside the home. You know, you're not, it's just, you know, the males around, if you're a boy, you know, the typical response is toughen up, man. Mm-hmm. Man, the typical response is getting punched in the chest, mm-hmm. right? Like a grown man will probably mm-hmm. punch you in the chest and say you need to toughen up.
Like some right? sort of rite of passage or some
Absolutely.
Sort of. And it, when you think about it, it's primal behavior
yeah.
that you want your boys to be tough. Do you see breakthroughs there? I like to think there are breakthroughs mm-hmm. in mental health recently. Do you see it?
You said something interesting earlier about systems. When it comes to mental health systems, I see a lot of good people, a lot of good agencies, a lot of good groups and different organizations that are trying their absolute best to do their absolute best in a system that doesn't seem to produce the best outcomes, mm-hmm. right? And you can define that however way you want to define it. But basically, I stopped doing quote-unquote mental health work or calling it that and officially doing that only because after a decade of working exclusively with Black boys and Black teens in Baltimore and Richmond and in Lynchburg, you know, it was a consistent pattern of me entering a child's life, being everything that they needed me to be. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Everything that they needed in their life, helping them get better. And the moment that they get better, I got to discharge.
You leave. Mm-hmm. Because that's the system. And if yeah. I have
never
to,
thought about that before.
I have to highlight this again. I have to. Research shows that if you are in a teenager's life, a child's life, for less than a calendar year, you do more harm than good.
Yeah.
So if you are plugged in to be intensive, whatever it is, and the system is designed to get whatever the system is going to get, and that's not talking about anything in specifics, but if you are there for less than a calendar year, you've done more harm than good. You're just reinforcing that people are coming in and out. And you're also being paid. And we always hear the theme of, does so-and-so care about me because they really care about me? Or do they care about me because they're paid to do whatever that is?
Yeah.
So I had to highlight that because you're saying that's powerful.
And it's just the truth. And mm-hmm. and I'm a realist at my core of who I am. I'm just a realist. And I try to do it in a way that is sensitive because I've met and know so many good people that work in the mental health field that dedicate so many of the time. I was that person, you know, and I always felt like I was doing good work and doing the right thing and put my all into it. And you can put your all into mm-hmm. it and maximize everything you have into it into a system that is designed essentially to, in many cases, make it worse. And I couldn't bring it myself within, you know, to do it. I couldn't bring myself to continue to do that in that way anymore.
Mm-hmm. But so we again, still need people who will.
Absolutely. And I'm not advocating against it. Yeah. I'm just saying what I am advocating for, though, is for people to begin looking at how we can improve the system, mm-hmm. right? That's what I'm essentially mm-hmm. trying to say. We need a system that is going to work for our clients better than what it currently is. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't say that lightly in terms of like how complicated it is because it is. You know, mm-hmm. we talk about insurance and how people get paid, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
and there's big,
yeah.
Mr. Day, the CEO here, when we were talking about child welfare, mental health, mm-hmm. public education, any system, there's big money in any system. Mm-hmm. We as a culture, we as a society have always rewarded intervention. The yeah. money is in the intervention, but you had to have already been in crisis, been in trauma, been in. So
it's self-perpetuating.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And so it's what I'm currently doing is, and I'm about to launch this soon, is a virtual peer support groups, right? It's not, I don't want to say it's an alternative to mental health because if you have yeah. some serious mental health mm-hmm. diagnoses and some things that you have going on, please seek a therapist and a counselor because you need it.
It's in addition to. It's right. another layer.
It's to complement it, basically, right? Because access to mental health, mm-hmm. very challenging, especially for Black men. When you look at our circumstances so many times, especially the fathers, right? You're if you're lucky enough to break through all these barriers, you're likely on some level of child support, right? You're probably working multiple times, multiple jobs. You probably have multiple children. You're trying to spend quality time with your kids. There's no room for an hour out of your week to be super vulnerable, to dig up some traumas, not only that you're going to say to someone who is you're very unfamiliar with, who probably is challenged to relate to your culture, but you've never said these things to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Literally. You're opening a trauma box. Mm.
And then go back to your job to be in a place where you're, you know what I mean? You're feeling all kinds of ways. You're not allowed to be. I mean, it's very, very challenging for Black males to find success in mental health the way it's currently designed and with the circumstances that many Black males find themselves in. And so what I found was, and I started this maybe about a year and a half ago, and we did it out of a spot downtown, you know, and it was incredibly successful, and the feedback that I got from it was powerful because I sort of just chose a group of powerful, inspiring Black men who hold positions, mm-hmm. like, you know, solid titles, some very credible, right, Black men in our community. And we just had a dialogue and we just created a safe space for everyone to sort of just be vulnerable a little bit and doing a check-in, like, how are you doing on a scale of 1 to 10, right? And the, like, if I, when I say to you, and I did it in a way where we recorded it and filmed it, but I told everybody I would never, you know, release anything that someone didn't want to be released, right? But I promise you, if I could release that film, it would go viral. It was so many powerful things said by strong, like, men in that room. It was obvious to me that that was something that is a need and something that could be facilitated and provided, you know. And so there is no place. You can't go home. You can't go to your grandmother's house. You can't go to work. You can't go to the gym. You can't go anywhere as a Black male and feel vulnerable and not feel like you're going to feel some type of retribution or you're going to be seen as weak or taken advantage of.
And I would even say, and as a male,
yes,
you know?
That's true. Yeah.
And as you all, there's been more of an emphasis on fatherhood over the last year or so.
Yeah.
And like we've said, there was a public forum where a group of dads spoke on fatherhood. You were one of them. And there were some really vulnerable things shared there. So I can only imagine how vulnerable it was when it wasn't public. And I think that it is so important for us to realize what we normalize. You keep hearing me say that word. Mm-hmm. We normalize things. We have mom's nights out or girls' nights or this. Very rarely do you ever hear of men having dad nights. You know, when you go golfing, do you talk about fatherhood?
Is it actually intentional?
Yes. Yeah. If you go play pickup basketball, are you talking about fatherhood? Are men encouraged to talk about fatherhood anywhere? Because we're constantly reinforcing mom groups or there's a whole Facebook page locally. Yeah. Are there dad Facebook pages? I don't know.
That's why I'm trying to fill this void.
Right. You know, and I had never thought of it.
Yeah. And it's a serious need. And like I said, when I saw it was surreal just in real time hearing what I heard coming out of people that I have such. And it's not that I lost any respect. I gained so much more respect because it's like, dude, I already saw you as a very strong person and someone that I admire and respect. And to hear what you just said and to understand what you're going through in the midst of all of this, I've just gained that much more respect.
Yeah, you get the whole picture of who they are.
Oh, I mean, it's It's and I realized, okay, if these are some of the strongest Black men that I associate with, right? Mm-hmm. If they're feeling like this, good Lord, you know, it's only I can only imagine what others are going through. And often I see social media posts, people who sometimes are just being just a little bit vulnerable and saying like, man, I'm really not feeling good. I'm feeling down. And I usually try to, hey man, if you need to talk, just hit me up, man, because I understand what you're going through and we're all going through. And I try to make people feel like they're not alone because that's how you feel. Like, no Black, you'll never, and I agree. It is, make no mistake about it. It's all men, right? It's not just a Black thing. But like I said, I try to advocate more for Black males. And so when I say that, that's the reason for it. Right. Yeah. But you'll never hear a Black man, you know what, I feel lonely. Mm-hmm. Or you'll never hear a Black male say, you know what, man, that really hurt my feelings. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's never going to happen, because I hope that that's a place that we get to where we have some type of emotional fluency, where we develop the emotional intelligence to be able to just talk about how we feel in a way that's productive, right? That can lead to some solutions and understand and be considerate of how other people feel when we speak and talk about things. We have existed in an environment for so long that's been so insensitive that we lose sight of how other people feel and who may be sensitive. Like, and I'm as guilty as this as anybody, or I've been in that environment as much as anybody. I'm somebody who grew up in a with males in my life who I absolutely love and adore and have done so much for me. But yes, I was somebody who was raised just insensitively, right?
It
was
I would say hyper-masculine.
Yes.
You know, when you think of hyper-masculine, like you were a football player, we normalize hyper-masculine behavior if you think about what's in the media.
And praise it.
Right. Yeah. We reward it. So we also have to think about, like, those are some systemic changes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the way I was raised, being a football player, I played college football. I went to VMI. It's literally probably the most insensitive institution on earth. Like, it's just super insensitive. And I mean that in the best way, but that's just the environment, the reality.
Or the system, or the history of military tradition.
Absolutely.
You know, all the things.
And it creates a level of energy, right, that just becomes, it molds you into a person that's a little bit insensitive. And so, I just try to be the best example as I can. And when I tell people that I'm someone who I probably struggle with expressing myself about how I feel more than anybody. And when I tell people that, they're shocked because they're like, dude, you do a really good job, like talking about how you feel and these things. Like I said, dude, that's because I've spent an enormous amount of time of intentionally like working on this because I was suffering from it. And if I didn't take the time to do it, I don't know where I was going to be if I didn't really start opening up. And it's been a journey, and people many years ago would have said the same thing, but it's like, I'm still a work in progress. There was times in 2023 or 2024 where I'm sitting on a sofa and I'm trying to express how I feel about a circumstance, say, that happened with my mom that I was going through. And I had finally felt a little bit probably more comfortable than I probably ever have. And thank God, you know, my lady, she just made me feel comfortable enough to be vulnerable. And man, when I say I boo-hoos, like, I'm talking like Kate Brilla. Like, I mean, it was clearly something that I desperately needed to release and just get out of me. And the healing that comes from that is so powerful. And that's what I want to do for the peer support groups, is create a safe environment where men feel safe enough to be vulnerable and ask questions, and we can empower each other and develop each other in ways, right? And refine so that we can heal. Mm-hmm. Because when healing happens, now we're better men, one, right? We're more godly men, we're everything. And it starts with healing, because we've just been in this system that hasn't allowed for that for so long. And I think when it comes to, when I look at the landscape of our social issues, so much of it stems back to healing that needs to take place. And when you look at the Black community, I can't think of a better way, you know. And so I'm looking to launch that soon. It's called King's Chamber, right? I use the word king because I just want to, I want all the men to just feel empowered and developed, right? Mm-hmm. And feel that, like, you matter, right? You are somebody, like, identity.
We need you.
Yeah, exactly. You know? It's a necessity, and identity is about as important as anything. Mm. Yeah.
Amen to that.
So, you know, I'm over here thinking of a way to kind of bring it all together for the folks listening and for us in this room. I really, really want you all to think every week as we have someone here on the sofa, Trey is talking about his place on the Vision 30 River. Mm-hmm. He's talking about his place in the village. And does this lead us closer to Vision 30? Absolutely. Are you keeping kids safe and making families stronger? Yes. So there are so many ways that people in this community and people anywhere that you're listening are doing Vision 30. Your focus is fatherhood. Your focus is on young men. Your focus is on your demographic. You're focusing on Black men and boys. We've talked to foster parents. We've talked to people who are in food ministry. We've talked to people who are doing financial literacy. Mm. There is a place for all of this work on the river.
Yeah.
And it is moving. And I love your emphasis on families, because we have to look at it holistically and we have to look at it systemically. So I appreciate you broadening my view today to think about different perspectives. So,
yeah,
it's been a treat.
It has.
Absolutely. And like I said, I've seen the journey. I've been around you and around several others at 518 long enough to see a strong desire to want to make a change and a difference in a community. And like, I'm authentic and I'm real. I'm a realist, you know, and I real recognize real. And you can't get to where you are today from where you were then without having a strong desire to want to make change in the community. And so I can only be appreciative and thankful for everything that 518 is doing as this organization just continues to grow and provide platforms like this too. You know, I think it's important to talk about these issues and for people to be able to hear and listen. And I wish 518 and this platform nothing but the best. It sounds like y'all are really doing some powerful things. And like I said, I'm just wishing nothing but the best.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm That's supportive. Awesome.
And I know you've said things today that people have never heard. I know that you peeled back some layers that some families needed to hear in this community. So I appreciate you.
Little things, small things.
Yes.
That, you know, we look at them as small. They're bigger than we think they are.
Yes.
Yep. So,
thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to the Mended Futures podcast, hosted by Allison Jordan and Taylor Melvin, produced by Liam Chafin, Sue England, Allison Jordan, Robert Day, Sully Jugar, and Taylor Melvin. You can find us on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to like, share, and subscribe to see more.